Hey there, Kindred Spirits. Thank you for making your way to Kindred Spirits Book Club, the podcast where two grown-ass ladies geek out about Anne of Green Gables. I'm Kelly Gerner, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Reagan Duffy.
Hi, Kindred Spirits. Kelly, how are you? Your birthday is coming up, and I'm so excited to celebrate it with you. You have to tell all the Kindred Spirits what you have planned for your birthday.
I'm so excited about it. Okay, so this isn't exactly a milestone birthday, but I still do like to do something a little festive and fun for my birthday. This year, I'm having a small group of close friends over to do a favorite things party. So the way that it works is this. You invite a group of friends who all have good taste, hopefully. Everybody brings three identical items that are all at the same price point. For our party, I picked $15 to $20. Then you do like a little bit of a show and tell or like a little QVC pitch and explain why this is one of your favorite things. This is an item that you use all the time. This is something you've replaced. Maybe it's a favorite skincare item that you get a lot of use of. Maybe it's a kitchen gadget that you're like, oh my God, this totally saves me so much time, or whatever it is. You explain to everybody why you love it. You put everything out on the table. Everybody gets a chance to kind of look and ooh and ah at everybody else's favorite things. And then you get to kind of go down the row and everybody picks a favorite thing. So you come in with three gifts. You leave with three gifts, and it's tons of fun for everybody. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we haven't done it yet.
I am so excited. I cannot wait to see what everybody brings. And I'm a little bit paralyzed with decision making because I have kind of a few too many ideas. So I've got to narrow it down.
Well, the first time I saw someone on TikTok doing this, I think I sent it to you right away. And I was like, Reagan, we have to do it.
Amazing.
So I'm glad that we're finally getting to it. I'm like you. I also have a few too many ideas. I mean, this is a big reason why we do our inspired by section on this podcast, because this is just like a mutual shared interest of both of ours, exposing each other to things we love.
Well, listeners, we will come back and tell you all about it after the birthday party.
So maybe a couple episodes down the road because we're recording this one in advance, but we will follow back up with you all.
Well, today, why don't we move into the rest of our episode? And today, our episode is going to be the character study on Leslie Moore. And it is extremely easy to tie the character of Leslie to our ongoing thematic discussion about Anne's pursuit of being divinely beautiful. As our listeners know, we've been using Anne's quote very early on in Anne of Green Gables, in which she asks Matthew whether it would be better to be angelically good, dazzlingly clever, or divinely beautiful. And talking about that over all of the books and the ways that that changes. We discussed last episode with Miss Cornelia in the House of Dreams that she both embodies and subverts the idea of goodness, and Leslie both embodies and subverts the theme of divine beauty as well.
Yeah. So, of course, our kindred spirit of the episode is Leslie Moore, the mysterious beauty who lives near the House of Dreams. Leslie is Anne and Gilbert's closest neighbor, but Anne meets her by chance, not by a conventional neighborly social call. Leslie is stunningly beautiful, deeply wounded, and struggling to get by, but too proud to ask for help. She's full of joyful abandon in one moment and full of prickly resentment in the next. Leslie is lively and intelligent enough to be an equal friend to Gilbert and Anne, but she's also cold, apprehensive, and standoffish, making it hard for the happy young newlyweds to truly connect with her. When we talk about Anne's genius for friendship, we almost see Leslie Moore as Anne's final exam. If Anne can win Leslie over, she can befriend anyone.
For our quote of the episode, here's a quote from Anne towards the end of the book, speaking to Leslie about their friendship. Anne says, "I am your friend, and you are mine, for always. Such a friend as I never had before. I have had many dear and beloved friends, but there's something in you, Leslie, that I never found in anyone else. You have more to offer me in that rich nature of yours, and I have more to give to you than I had in my careless girlhood. We are both women and friends forever." Ah, it's such a lovely statement of friendship.
Oh, I really love that quote. Good choice, friend.
For Story Club, let's get right into talking about Leslie Moore. Anne's friendship with Leslie is not the easy friendship that Anne forged with Diana. That friendship was truly effortless on Anne's part. It was the perfect combination of a young girl desperate for a friend, meeting another girl with an open heart and an open mind. Anne and Diana's friendship sprung up fully formed in one afternoon, and, as they remind each other before Anne goes to college, has never been marred by a fight or a misunderstanding. And Anne's friendships with the girls of Patty's Place, like Philippa Gordon, are also pretty effortless. We don't know much about how Anne builds a friendship with Priscilla and Stella, just that she saw them at Queen's on the first day, and they are described as vivid and red rosy in the case of Stella, and pale and fair with lovely hair in the case of Priscilla. And Anne quickly pegs them as people she'd like to get to know. And with Phil, it's much the same. Anne and Priscilla spot Phil at orientation at Redmond, and they think she's the most beautiful girl there, and they want to get to know her. And when Phil approaches the two of them later in the graveyard, they become friends instantly. We've always joked that Anne's kindred spirit radar makes snap judgments, but is rarely wrong. We have yet to see her identify a kindred spirit who turns out to not be a kindred spirit. And all of these girlhood friendships are with girls whose spirits are as lighthearted and joyful as Anne's, and their friendships are defined by adventures, daydreams, youthful ambition, and most of all, a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to call this right out here and note that Anne's first interest in a friend appears to be their beauty, right?
I mean, it definitely seems like it.
And, you know, part of that is just how Maude may be describing her characters.
Sure.
But we also do get to see Anne's thoughts when she's meeting all these young women, and her first descriptor is always related to their appearance. And we know that very young Anne is rather preoccupied with both her appearance and the appearance of others. Besides that iconic quote about despairing that she'll never be angelically good, dazzlingly clever, or divinely beautiful in her very first encounter with her, we also hear that she is sure she will never be beautiful because her red hair is her lifelong sorrow. When Marilla says that she will take Anne over to Orchard Slope to meet Diana Barry, Anne's first question is about what Diana looks like and that she's hoping for a beautiful best friend. Marilla, practical, moral, religious Marilla, is rightly appalled by this. But we've discussed at length how young Anne has always equated beauty with being loved and how her own lack of beauty is part of the reason why she has not been loved. In fact, if you're interested, you can go back to episode 12, in which we unpack young Anne's relationship to beauty in more depth. We also know that what Marilla thinks of as vanity, Anne's preoccupation with looks, hers and others, for Anne, it's more of an outgrowth of her love of beauty in general. Anne loves a beautiful flower and a glorious sunset and a stirring poem and evocative words. She delights in the things that make life beautiful. For her, enjoying having beautiful friends and beautiful clothes is just part of the experience of appreciating the loveliness in the world. Now, Anne is not so shallow that beauty is her only criteria for a kindred spirit. For instance, while Anne was friends with Ruby Gillis, the prettiest girl in school, Ruby never rose to a true kindred spirit level of friendship. But it's still very easy to spot this theme of Anne's friendships arising out of her admiration of her friend's looks. Even now, when Anne is a grown adult, we catch her in this preoccupation. When Captain Jim tells Anne the story of the schoolmaster's bride, Anne's first question is, "Was Persis Lee beautiful?" And Captain Jim says, "It was actually hard to say because Persis Lee was such a lovely person. You never got around to wondering if she was beautiful or not."
You know what? Wise old Captain Jim for the win. Reagan, I'm kind of curious. Are you experiencing this? I'm starting to feel like as I get older, I notice physical appearance a lot less, both for myself and for others. I think most of the people I know are lovely, but I think it's because, as Captain Jim says, I know they have good souls and their loveliness is radiating from that, not from any physical feature.
Right. I think that's true. Or maybe I just have more appreciation for all the different ways that beauty looks now. And maybe that's the benefit of getting older a little. I think of beauty less as a monolith, as achieving a particular ideal, and more as seeing how someone is so singular that everyone is so specifically beautiful themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know that scene in the Barbie movie where Barbie, who's now in the real world, sees an elderly lady at the bus stop? And when she's caught staring, she just tells her, "You're so beautiful." And the elderly lady smiles and says, "I know it. I don't know about you, but that scene absolutely made me tear up because there's something so lovely and simple about it, but it's so profound because Barbie is noticing this specific woman, and that's what's beautiful.
I really love that scene. I think that's a perfect way to exemplify this notion.
But for Anne, at least in this moment of her life, she's still looking for beauty in everything and everyone. And I think Anne's preoccupation with beauty is a theme that actually might bother more modern readers. I know we've had a listener email us asking about how we might approach this issue if she were to introduce the Anne books to her daughter.
We seriously have the most thoughtful listeners.
I know. We love
you guys. The emails and DMs we get from you guys. I love that you are reading the books as closely and lovingly as we are.
I think that many of us in our generation and the younger generations as well, we're trying really hard to deconstruct our relationship to physical beauty and give our kids a more inclusive and deeper perspective. So it is a bit jarring to read how often Anne comments on the appearance of herself and others. I think more modern books try to emphasize physical beauty a lot less or take care to paint their characters in more fully developed ways than just appearance, although it's certainly not gone entirely.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, Regan, and I'm glad we're calling it out now. I'm also going to talk about this a little bit in our Birch Path, but, you know, for a long time, I mean, and like you said, to be honest, even still today, although I think we are getting better about it, but for the longest time, authors used beauty as a way to tell readers that they should be invested in a character. It's like a shortcut to actual character development. Like, who needs details when an author can simply say, oh, the girl was beautiful and chaste, and then that's all we need to know about why we should care about her. But not only does that result in really shallow characterizations, it also perpetuates harmful stereotypes that conventionally attractive people are more valuable.
I'd actually love to talk about this idea a little more. And one thing that I'm thinking about is from the parenting perspective. Like, how do you share books or other media that you loved as a kid with your child without co-signing some of those problematic ideas?
Yes.
For me, the approach I've taken is just to try to give my daughter context. So, for instance, any parents who have read Harry Potter out loud to their kids or Roald Dahl books out loud to their kids will maybe find themselves having to grapple with the way that those authors use larger body sizes or someone's looks as a way of conveying that a character is lazy or selfish or greedy, or a character who is ugly on the outside. It's supposed to tell us that they're ugly on the inside.
Yeah, I hate that. And it is really so prevalent, especially unfortunately in the books and media that we grew up with. You know, and nowadays it's just like, if all your fat characters are the antagonists, you're doing it wrong. So Regan, how are you handling this with your daughter?
What I do is I just call it out. I name it as we read or watch if it's a movie. I say, this bothers me. The author is describing this character's body in a really mean way, not a neutral way. And she's using that as a shortcut to telling us that the character is bad. And I remember specifically saying that about the way that J.K. Rowling describes the Dursleys when we were reading Harry Potter. So I just talked to her directly about how, you know, hey, we could do this differently. We could just describe the character's actions to tell us about who they are. The Dursleys do plenty of horrible stuff. We do not have to rag on their appearances as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't belabor it. I just address it and then go on with the reading. We can still enjoy the book, but we can also point out the harmful stereotypes. My husband always thinks I go a little overboard with it, especially if we're watching a movie or a TV show. I'll stop it and I'll say something like that if that's appropriate. But you know what? I think it's working.
Yes.
So my husband had been reading aloud to Alice some old school Nancy Drew books. I mean, those were absolute favorites for me as a kid. And she was definitely enjoying the story. But then I overheard her say, well, how come every time they refer to Nancy, they make a big deal of how pretty she is? Why are they always saying the pretty detective or whatever? That's not the most important part about her.
Ah, go Alice.
So, you know, I think reading the Anne books with your child, you can just have a conversation about this fallacy of Anne's. Anne thinks it's really important to be beautiful, but of course, that's not the most important thing about a person at all. Just ask your kids what they think when Anne says one of her more appalling lines.
Right, right. I'd honestly be so curious about what the kiddos now with, you know, hopefully some of these more evolved perspectives on these ideas of beauty, a shorthand for worthiness. I wonder what they would make of Anne. Would they think that she was really shallow?
I know Alice definitely picked up on it when we talked about Anne. Oh. I think if you ask them the questions as they're reading or as you guys are reading it together, you might be surprised with what they tell you.
I think with some of this stuff, It's so insidious, some of these more problematic characterizations, or, you know, the way we talk about people who do not fit the beauty ideal. And we think that maybe if we just don't mention it, that they won't notice it. But it's almost the opposite, right? Where it's like almost if you don't mention it, then you're co-signing it. So you kind of have to say it loud and you have to pause the movie and like make a big fuss about it just for a moment and then, you know, let it go on to show them that like, we're not co-signing this. We're not just agreeing that this is how it should be. You know, these people have a wrong idea, and I want you to think about why that is.
Exactly. And we've talked about how ideas around the way we talk about these things or conceptualize these things have changed over time. So we can appreciate what we had, what we're getting from that media from before. Like, it doesn't mean we can't still enjoy it, but we can understand that we would not want to still bring that thinking today. Anyway, let's bring it back to Anne here.
Yeah.
And with Anne and Leslie, at first it seems that their meeting could just follow this well-worn pattern of Anne's other friendships. Anne sees a beautiful woman. She's intrigued by her. She'll connect with her immediately, and then they'll be best buddies and confidants and fast friends. But this time, it doesn't go exactly to plan. So when Anne first sees Leslie, it's on the road as she and Gilbert are driving to their house of dreams for the first time, though she doesn't know who she is or that she's their neighbor in this moment. Anne is startled by the woman's stunning beauty. She seems too beautiful for the very ordinary task that she's engaged in, herding her geese through the hills. But when Anne's and Leslie's eyes meet, instead of the flash of kinship that occurred with Phil Gordon or Priscilla or Stella, Anne instead encounters a hardness, a hostility in Leslie's glance. That is much different than what Anne has experienced before. Here's how Leslie is described from Anne's point of view. It was the girl's beauty which made Anne give a gasp, a beauty so marked that it must have attracted attention anywhere. She was hatless, but heavy braids of burnished hair, the hue of ripe wheat, were twisted about her head like a coronet. Her eyes were blue and star-like. Her figure in its plain print gown was magnificent, and her lips were as crimson as the bunch of blood-red poppies she wore at her belt. Anne's curiosity is quickly forgotten, though, as they arrive at the House of Dreams and start their married life together.
Regan, this description is so bananas, if you think about it. I mean, I know it's Maud, and we know she loves an enthusiastic, glowing description of a beautiful sight. But with Leslie, the kinds of words that Maud is using, like coronet and star-like, magnificent and blood red, I mean, these are the kinds of words you'd use to describe a goddess of ancient myth, not any kind of like village beauty. And this really gets to Leslie's singularity in her appearance, right? She has this like Helen of Troy quality. She's so beautiful. She's so noticeable. It's almost dangerous.
Yeah. Anne is constantly using poets' phrases to describe Leslie.
Mm-hmm.
This initial description is followed up by Anne asking Gilbert if he saw this woman. And when Gilbert hadn't noticed her because he was only paying attention to Anne.
Oh,
love. Anne tells him, "I never saw such a face except in pictures. And her hair, it made me think of Browning's Gourd of Gold and Gorgeous Snake." So she's pulling straight from the poets immediately.
Right, right. You know, I would argue that this is quite purposefully done on Maud's end. Not only do we have this overwrought description of Leslie right from the top, but, you know, she will literally be referred to as a goddess later in the book multiple times. She is, I think, that real life manifestation of childhood Anne's wildest dreams about beauty, right? So recall 11-year-old Anne with her head full of chivalric sagas and epic poetry. She would have believed that if she were beautiful like Leslie, she were that level of lovely, she would be safe and wanted and loved. And not just loved, adored. You know, and now in her adulthood, Anne is about to learn that this kind of beauty does not go hand in hand with an easy life. When Anne finally meets Leslie for real, when they have their first real conversation, Anne is dancing along the shore, inspired by the raw beauty of the ocean. Then she is a little embarrassed to realize that the gorgeous woman she had glimpsed before was watching her from the beach. Listen to this description. Quote, "She was bareheaded, and her splendid hair, more than ever like Browning's Gorgeous Snake, was bound around her head with a crimson ribbon. She wore a dress of some dark material, very plainly made, but swathed about her waist, outlining its fine curves, was a vivid girdle of red silk. Her hands, clasped over her knee, were brown and somewhat work-hardened, but the skin of her throat and cheeks was as white as cream. A flying gleam of sunset broke through the low-lying western cloud and fell across her hair. For a moment, she seemed the spirit of the sea personified, all its mystery, all its passion, all its elusive charm. Again, we have this mythological connotation here. Leslie is not of this world. Her hands may be hardened by work, but her throat is as white as cream. Her dress is plain, but she is adorned with a crimson ribbon and red silk girdle. And in this case, we think that a girdle is likely more like a wide belt and not necessarily like shapewear, which is, you know, probably the connotation we have today.
It's not Spanx.
No, it's not Spanx. And then we have this shaft of sunset light, like something from a JMW Turner oil painting, that's lighting up her splendid hair, making her look not like a naiad or a sea nymph or some fanciful little fairy creature, but like the spirit of the sea itself. I mean, this is a really profound description, far beyond what we tend to see in Maud's writing.
Yeah, certainly, at least in the way that she describes people.
Yeah.
Very over the top.
So here's Anne, frolicking on the beach, and she realizes Leslie, this goddess, is watching her and looking at her with wonder, sympathy, and envy. Again, huge emotions, huge words for a mere mortal woman. And Anne is embarrassed, but she manages to recover and introduce herself properly. "Let's introduce ourselves," she said, with the smile that had never yet failed to win confidence and friendliness. "I am Mrs. Blythe, and I live in that little white house up the harbor shore." Okay, so first of all, how cute is it that she can finally now introduce herself as Mrs. Blythe?
I know.
We love it. But second of all, here we see Anne's practiced geniality in play, right? She knows how to make a good impression even after she's done something a bit foolish, right? We've seen her do this time and again. And so it's telling that Maud describes Anne's smile as one that had never yet failed to win confidence and friendliness. Anne is truly genuine, and that comes through in her smile. And most people respond very, very quickly to Anne. And Anne has kind of come to expect that at this point. But Leslie responds simply that she knows who Anne is, and she acknowledges that she's Anne's neighbor and that she should have gone over to introduce herself by now. She doesn't make any excuses for not having done so yet, which is definitely interesting.
Yeah, she's acknowledging that she's been a bit rude by not coming over, but she's not apologizing for it.
Yeah.
Anne shares that she loves four winds and the sea, and Leslie agrees. Anne says that she's met Miss Cornelia. And Leslie tells Anne that Miss Cornelia is her best friend in the whole world, a statement Anne finds surprising as Miss Cornelia hasn't spoken of Leslie to Anne yet. And then Anne compliments Leslie on her beauty. "I suppose I am beautiful," Leslie went on, looking stormily out to sea. "I hate my beauty. I wish I had always been as brown and plain as the brownest and plainest girl at that fishing village over there."
Now that sentiment must really startle Anne, who spent her childhood yearning to be beautiful and her young adulthood finding her own beauty and celebrating that same thing in her friends as well. I don't think Anne has ever imagined that someone would not want to be beautiful.
Right. Well, Leslie turns the conversation back to a safe subject, their shared friend, Miss Cornelia, and Anne follows her lead. When Anne asks Leslie to come visit and often so they can become friends, Leslie wonders out loud if Anne would like her. Anne, who likes nearly everyone, says that she's sure she would like Leslie and Leslie would like her back. And Leslie shouldn't believe that Anne is silly for dancing on the beach. She's just a newlywed after all and still learning how to be serious. Leslie responds that she's been married 12 years. Anne is shocked by this revelation. "You must have been a child when you were married," she says. "I was 16, said Leslie, rising and picking up the cap and jacket lying beside her. "I'm 28 now. Well, I must go back." And Leslie extremely reluctantly says Anne should come and see her. So obviously reluctant that Anne double checks and says, well, only if Leslie really wants her to. Leslie bursts out eagerly, "Oh, I do. Almost like it's against her will. Leslie leaves Anne with the sense that the conversation has gone badly, that Anne went wrong somewhere along the line. Unsettled, she tries to explain to Gilbert that Leslie might not be a kindred spirit now, but Anne thinks Leslie once was and is now in exile. Anne explains, quote, "You will understand her fascination when you meet her, Gilbert. It is a thing quite apart from her beauty. I feel that she possesses a rich nature into which a friend might enter as into a kingdom. But for some reason, she bars everyone out and shuts all her possibilities up in herself so they cannot develop and blossom. There, I've been struggling to define her to myself ever since I left her, and that is the nearest I can get to it. I'm going to ask Miss Cornelia about her."
Okay, this is quite a pronouncement after this, like, super awkward meeting at the beach. You know, we have a lot of textual evidence for Anne's intuition when it comes to people, so I'm inclined to believe her. But based on the conversation we saw on the page, I'm not sure we can definitively say that Leslie, quote, possesses a rich nature into which a friend might enter as into a kingdom. Again, we're falling back to this sort of divine language, right? Leslie is not a mere woman living in a little gray house near the shore. She has whole kingdoms inside her.
Yeah, I'm very curious how Anne got to Leslie's, quote, rich nature, which is a phrase used multiple times in the book to describe Leslie, from this little interaction. I certainly get fascination. Leslie's extremely contradictory, cold and short, but also weirdly honest when she tells Anne that she hates her beauty. And then at the last second, she betrays a desire to actually be friends with Anne.
Yeah.
And Anne, who loves beauty, may be confusing Leslie's outer appearance with a personality that matches that radiance. I mean, Anne certainly isn't the only person to fall into that trap. It's a known psychological effect. There really is pretty privilege. Anne then gets the whole story of Leslie's past from Miss Cornelia. It's not a secret. Everyone in the area knows of the tragedy of Leslie Moore, and Miss Cornelia assumes Anne will be better off if she has some context. Miss Cornelia explains that Leslie's mother was the town beauty, and her father was clever and shiftless, just like a man. I mean, by now, we've learned to take some of Miss Cornelia's judgments about men with a grain of salt. It seems like Leslie's dad was charming and fun, and Leslie adored him as a child. The West family was poor, but happy, and Leslie loved her parents and her younger brother, Kenneth. Miss Cornelia says, Leslie had her mother's looks and her father's brains, and something she didn't get from either of them. She took after her grandmother West, a splendid old lady. She was the brightest, friendliest, merriest thing when she was a child, and everybody liked her. When Leslie was 12, her younger brother Kenneth was killed in a farming accident. He fell off a wagon bearing a load of hay and was crushed beneath the wagon wheel. Leslie saw the whole thing happen. She held her brother as he died and had to be torn away from his body. It's absolutely tragic. And while that alone would be enough to cast a veil of grief over anyone's life, it was really just the beginning for Leslie, who seems to be cursed with tragedy. Another way she reminds us of a figure from myth. After her brother's death, Leslie's father sank into a deep depression. He stopped working and eventually died by suicide on his wedding anniversary, no less. And Leslie found his body.
Miss Cornelia gives Anne a detail that I really think tells us so much about Leslie. Leslie didn't cry at either her brother's or her father's funerals, while her mother, quote, whooped and howled for two, according to Miss Cornelia. That's when I think those parent-child roles reversed, and Leslie came to believe herself to be responsible for her mother. You know, Leslie and her mother were already terribly poor. Their farm was mortgaged to the hilt, but her mother still paid for a grand monument to Leslie's father in the graveyard, spending much, much more than their struggling family could have afforded. So we know that Leslie's mom wasn't able to make these, like, solid choices in the face of her grief. And then here's Leslie, who's telling herself that she has to be the adult. She has to make wise financial decisions. She cannot allow herself to succumb to her grief. She has to do it all. Leslie's grandmother died next, but this loss came with a small boon, enough money to give Leslie a year at Queen's Academy. Leslie did what Gilbert and Anne did and took 2 years of teacher training in one in the hopes that she could return home, teach, and support her mother. Miss Cornelia explains, quote, Leslie was full of ambition and her head was chock full of brains. She went to Queens and she took 2 years work in 1 year and got her first. And when she came home, she got the Glen School. She was so happy and hopeful and full of life and eagerness. When I think of what she was then and what she is now, I say, drat the men. Right? And we see how Leslie was kind of on the same trajectory as Anne, right? Going to Queens, working at the local school, full of life and hope and eagerness.
And I think what's interesting also about this is that at this point, she's already experienced two very serious tragedies and yet has bounced back in a really amazing way. She's still ambitious. She's still found hope and life and sees a really positive future for herself.
Yeah, I think that's right. So Miss Cornelia says, drat the men. And in this case, by the men, Miss Cornelia means specifically Dick Moore. Dick, who we described in our recap episode as a kind of Gaston from Beauty and the Beast type, but like less funny, took one look at Leslie and decided that she should be his, as though the fact that a woman caught his eye means that she belongs to him. Dick is awful. Dick is awful. At first, Leslie wouldn't give him the time of day, which only made him want her more. And that's really the flip side of great beauty, right? You'd think, as young Anne did, that beauty would make your life easier. But beautiful women throughout time have had to deal with this very insidious and harmful aspect of the patriarchy. If you are too pretty, men will make your life miserable until they own you.
Right. Women's worth has been, for centuries, and still is, defined by their value to men, which often comes down to how they look, and men feeling like they are owed women's beauty. Mm-hmm. A beautiful woman doesn't belong to herself. She's an object to be possessed.
And so Dick Moore does exactly this. It turns out that Dick's father owns the mortgage on the family farm, and Dick tells Leslie's mother that if Leslie does not agree to marry him, Dick will call the mortgage in. Leslie and her mother have no money and are certain to lose the farm if Leslie declines. Miss Cornelia tells Anne that Leslie's mother, quote, fainted and wept and pleaded with Leslie not to let her be turned out of her home. She said it would break her heart to leave the home she'd come to as a bride. Now, remember that Leslie feels responsible for her mother. She doesn't feel free to tell her mother no or to cause her mother any more disappointment and hurt. So Leslie agrees to marry Dick. Miss Cornelia said that Leslie's expression at her wedding was the same as her expression at her brother's and father's funerals. Leslie and Dick moved in with Leslie's mother, who died of pneumonia only a year later, leaving Leslie stuck in a marriage with a man she could never love. And although Miss Cornelia doesn't tell us this in this section of the book, it's hinted later on and in other conversations with Cornelia and Captain Jim that that marriage was ultimately an abusive one. Not long after this, Dick decided to go off to sea with his cousin from Nova Scotia, leaving Leslie home alone. When he didn't come back as expected, people began to speculate that he'd died at sea, although Leslie didn't believe it herself. Captain Jim, who was still sailing back then, took it upon himself to look for Dick in Havana, Cuba, where Dick's ship had been headed. Captain Jim found a man in a boarding house who looked just like Dick, same build, same eyes, two different colors, and carried a letter from Leslie in his pocket. But the man had been injured in a fight and suffered brain damage, which had caused memory loss and left him with the mental capacity of a young child. Captain Jim brought Dick home to Leslie, who ever since then had been his full-time caregiver, with no way to earn money other than to rent her family's farm and with no one to help her. Miss Cornelia explains that Dick needs round-the-clock care, and only after he goes to bed is Leslie free to do anything for herself, which is likely when she met Anne that evening by the shore.
It's a lot. It is a truly tragic story. But hearing Leslie's history strengthens Anne's resolve to befriend her and help in any way she can. Anne's tendency to romanticize her world has fresh inspiration in Leslie. Quote, Leslie Moore stood apart, a tragic, appealing figure of thwarted womanhood. Anne resolved that she would win entrance into the kingdom of that lonely soul and find there the comradeship it could so richly give, were it not for the cruel fetters that held it in a prison not of its own making.
Okay, now that is an interesting response on Anne's part.
Yeah.
It's one thing to be sympathetic to a person who has had a very difficult and challenging life by any perspective. And it's another thing to see an ordinary woman, your peer, your neighbor, as like the heroine of a Shakespearean tragedy, and then appoint yourself as the savior who is going to find a way to connect with her.
Anne is really framing this like a heroic quest.
Yes, yes, very much so. And as much as we talk about how Anne now is all grown up in Anne's House of Dreams, I think her initial relationship with Leslie has some of those exact same hallmarks of her early friendship with Diana. Like half of it is in Anne's head without any kind of understanding of the reality the other person is living.
Oh, yeah. She's taking it upon herself to save Leslie. And that's a bit of hubris on Anne's part here. Does Leslie want saving? Now, we know that, in fact, Leslie does need Anne's friendship. But I also think that Anne is thinking that friendship will be enough to fix Leslie. She's also making a lot of assumptions about what Leslie's true personality is like. She's assuming a sort of nobility of nature here because she's experienced so much tragedy. In any case, between Captain Jim and Miss Cornelia's influence, Leslie does seek out Anne's friendship. And Anne's genius for people is on display in the way that she quickly hurdles the first barrier to Leslie's friendship, her embarrassment about Dick Moore's disability. Anne references it quickly and matter-of-factly, understanding that Leslie doesn't want to have to tell her herself, and in doing so, lets Leslie know that Anne is not judging either Leslie or Dick. As Leslie accepts Anne's hospitality and with it her frank friendship, that change in Leslie is again described in terms of her physical beauty. Quote, Her beautiful hair gleamed like molten gold in the warm firelight. Her sea blue eyes were full of soft laughter and allurement. For the moment, under the influence of the little house of dreams, she was a girl again, a girl forgetful of the past and its bitterness. We do get to see a bit more than that. We see that being with two intelligent, warm young people such as Anne and Gilbert in a comforting, happy little home brings out Leslie's personality. Maud writes, Anne found it hard to believe that this was the cold, unresponsive woman she had met on the shore, this animated girl who talked and listened with the eagerness of a starved soul. Anne and Leslie bond over books, and the time passes quickly. Anne and Gilbert invite her to come back often. And then we see that when Leslie takes in the hope and joy in the relationship between Anne and Gilbert, the easiness between the two of them, her bitterness seeps back in and her walls come up again. She turns cold and hurries away. Afterwards, Anne again raves to Gilbert about Leslie's beauty, which I do think is a bit odd. And that's not because Anne and Gilbert can't both admire Leslie's beauty. It's just like, if I had a great first evening with a potential new friend and the conversation sparkled and I felt that thread of connection building between us, that's what I'd want to talk about with my husband. I'd be all like, wasn't that so much fun? She was so wonderful to talk to. I can't wait to talk about books with her, whatever it is, right?
Reagan, it's really rude that you didn't run home and tell Steve how beautiful I am.
Kelly, you don't know I didn't. Maybe what Anne says is what I said. And what Anne says is, isn't she lovely, Gilbert? Her hair fascinates me. Miss Cornelia says it reaches to her feet. Ruby Gillis had beautiful hair, but Leslie's is alive. Every thread of it is living gold.
Okay, actually, speaking of rude, poor Ruby is dead. Leave her hair alone.
It was nice, but come on.
Come on. This woman's hair is alive, unlike Ruby.
Who's dead?
Anne!
Well, Gilbert agrees, naturally, and Anne's own feelings about her red hair that she thought she had made peace with rear up a little bit. But Gilbert reminds Anne that she wouldn't be her without her red hair, and she is his, quote, queen of my heart and life and home. Oh, swoon.
Oh.
So again, despite hearing about how Leslie's beauty led to her being trapped like a princess in a tower, Anne is enraptured by Leslie's appearance, even though it's very clear that they did connect as friends.
One thing I also kind of wanted to discuss in this episode is that in Victorian literature, I mean, I guess in Victorian culture at large, but certainly in Victorian literature, a woman's hair was very specifically a metaphor for her sexuality. And like the longer, thicker, and more beautiful her hair was, the more sexual the woman was believed to be. And really, this even kind of predates Victorian times. There are references to women's hair in Shakespeare that are clearly metaphors for sexuality. But the like obsession with hair as the center of a woman's feminine power really reached a fever pitch in the Victorian era. I mean, like erotic photographs and things like that in that era are all like women with super long hair. There's like hair jewelry that was made. I mean, it was an interesting fascination of that time period. But so anyway, I point this out here for two reasons, right? One, I do think that Maud is using Anne's fascination with Leslie's hair, well, either to challenge or maybe even to play into the assumptions that people were making about women's hair at this time. I'm not really sure I know which one. I mean, I think that could be like an essay in and of itself. But two, to your point, Reagan, it's so weird that Anne and Gilbert are obsessing over this woman's hair. I mean, it's like quasi-sexual, right? Like, you guys, leave Leslie alone.
That's really interesting about kind of the cultural context around the obsession with hair. Now that you say this, it makes sense of kind of this constant subtext about how Leslie is suited for more life than this. And that's both about her beauty and about a vibrancy of spirit that I think is a way of getting at the idea of her repressed, passionate nature.
Mm.
In more modern books, that could be directly expressed as sexuality.
Yeah, I think that subtext is absolutely present here. So Anne wants to deepen her friendship with Leslie. When Gilbert must be away from home, Anne feels the absence of a good girlfriend. And even though Captain Jim and Miss Cornelia are already kindred spirits, as Maud puts it, youth yearn to youth. And so, on a ghostly night while Gilbert is at a medical conference, that feeling is so strong. So Anne takes herself over to Leslie's for some of that youthful comradeship. And there, Anne sees Leslie at her kitchen table, her head buried in her arms, weeping stormily, all alone except for her dog, with his head in her lap. Anne's instinct in regard to Leslie is correct again. And she knows that if she goes in, if she sort of breaks the spell as her sympathetic soul yearns to do, Leslie's pride will never let her get close to Anne. To have happy, joyful, fulfilled Anne see the depths of Leslie's despair at this early stage of their friendship would be so vulnerable that it would kill any chance of real closeness later on. Anne's right, of course, and so she slips back out of the garden. She meets Captain Jim as she does, who is bringing Dick Moore back home, having taken charge of him for the evening to give Leslie a break. Oh, Captain Jim. Jim affirms Anne's decision and says Leslie rarely cries, being too brave and proud to do so. And clearly, Leslie's response to any kind of vulnerability is to freeze out others and flee. Ugh, poor Leslie. It just seems like she's made an already very hard life so much harder by feeling like she can't ask for help with her burdens.
Yeah.
But over the next few chapters, Anne and Leslie do grow closer in fits and starts. Leslie visits Captain Jim's lighthouse with the Blythes, Miss Cornelia, and Marshall Elliot, and they listen to Captain Jim's tales and play music and just sort of carouse and have a good time. And Anne notices that everyone is better when Leslie is part of their group. Captain Jim's stories are better, Gilbert is wittier, Anne is even more creative.
Anne and Leslie take walks together on the shore. They sit and watch the sea from the rocks, and they share intimacies. As winter sets in, Anne and Leslie take rambles in snowshoes. They spin around the icy harbor on Captain Jim's ice boat and have long fireside chats. Leslie misses Christmas at the House of Dreams, but she does join the group at the lighthouse for a New Year's celebration. Captain Jim takes out his old brown fiddle, and Marshall Elliot sings and dances. Leslie soon joins him. Maud tells us that, quote, Leslie danced like one inspired. The wild, sweet abandon of the music seemed to have entered into and possessed her. Anne watched her in fascinated admiration. She had never seen her like this. All the innate richness and color and charm of her nature seemed to have broken loose and overflowed in crimson cheek and glowing eye and grace of motion. Even the aspect of Marshall Elliot with his long beard and hair could not spoil the picture. On the contrary, it seemed to enhance it. Marshall Elliot looked like a Viking of elder days, dancing with one of the blue-eyed, golden-haired daughters of the Northland.
Okay, so now Norse mythology also joins the picture. Is there any sort of mythological connotation that Leslie's beauty cannot evoke? I mean, I'm having a little fun at Maud's expense here, but when we are constantly seeing this theme crop up, we need to ask why she's doing this. Why is it so vital to understand Leslie as no mere mortal? We also have that really interesting observation that Leslie improves the conversation and society of any group that she's in, that people are the best versions of themselves when she's around. Leslie is the secret spice that enhances the flavor of the whole dish, right? Anne tells Gilbert that Leslie is wasted in a small provincial community and that she should be a social leader in one of the great cities in the world. I think what's happening here is that Anne is reckoning with this tension that's really of her own creation. Anne believes that legendary beauties like Leslie should not live happy lives in places like Four Winds PEI. She believes they should exist in poetry and myth, or at the very least in Toronto. Anne may have happily accepted a hometown boy and a small but lovely house instead of a handsome prince and a castle of dreams, but she doesn't believe Leslie should have to. And this belief on Anne's part, I think, intensifies the tragedy of Leslie's experiences, which, by the way, hardly need intensifying. But for Anne, it's not just that, you know, a village girl from PEI has suffered these terrible things. It's that this ethereal goddess is suffering from common mortal tragedies. And that is just too much for Anne's romantic outlook on life to reconcile. Yet, reconcile it she must if she is to be Leslie's friend for real.
Yeah, it's very interesting because that's this almost bigger part of Leslie's tragedy that everybody else is talking about is the waste that she's squandered. Yes. And again, not in the more common way of the fact that she's trapped in kind of this loveless, caretaking sort of marriage, but the fact that she is so spectacular, she was destined for something much greater, much more fulfilling.
Yeah.
When Anne tells Captain Jim that she is sure she will never truly be able to be close to Leslie, he encourages her to keep trying, saying that he and Miss Cornelia have noticed that Leslie is doing better with Anne in the mix. And he also says this really interesting line. You've been too happy all your life, Mistress Blythe, said Captain Jim thoughtfully. I reckon that's why you and Leslie can't get real close together in your souls. The barrier between you is her experience of sorrow and trouble. She ain't responsible for it, and you ain't, but it's there, and neither of you can cross it. My childhood wasn't very happy before I came to Green Gables, said Anne, gazing soberly out the window in the still, sad, dead beauty of the lifeless tree shadows on the moonlit snow. Maybe not, but it was just the usual unhappiness of a child who hasn't anyone to look after it properly. There hasn't been any tragedy in your life, Mistress Blythe, and poor Leslie has been almost all tragedy. She feels, I reckon, though maybe she hardly knows she feels it, that there's a vast deal in her life you can't enter nor understand, and she has to keep you back from it, hold you off, so to speak, from hurting her. You know, if we've got anything about us that hurts, we shrink from anyone's touch on or near it. It holds good with our souls as well as our bodies, I reckon. Leslie's soul must be near raw. It's no wonder she hides it away.
Okay, Reagan, what do you make of Captain Jim's assessment of the gulf between Leslie and Anne? I do think he's right about Leslie. She wants to keep people and experiences at arm's length to protect herself from future hurt. But I don't think he's right about Anne's childhood. If we think about what we now know about the importance of early childhood, I almost think that Anne's many early years of neglect may have held the possibility for an even more negative outcome than Leslie's many tragedies, which she experienced later in life after a happy childhood. I think Anne and Leslie are probably better matched than Leslie or Captain Jim seem to believe.
You're right in a way, but I do see some of his point, though. Mm. Adult Anne has everything her heart has always desired.
Yeah.
And so many more dreams for the future seem likely to be realized. Anne has hope, has always had hope, even when she was a child before Green Gables. Anne's early life was tragic, but all the things she hoped for, they came to pass.
Yeah.
At this point, Leslie has no hope. It's not just that Leslie has experienced tragedy, it's that her tragedy is ongoing with no end in sight. Anytime she has started to hope again in her life, another tragedy struck it down. And that's a tricky bridge to cross between the two of them.
Mm.
It accounts for the way that Leslie's mood seemed to seesaw between open, loving friendship with Anne and resentment, even hatred, that make her turn cold and retreat. I do think it really goes to show that Anne is being a very good friend to Leslie. She keeps showing up for her and inviting her in when Leslie has the emotional capacity for connection and trying her best not to take it too personally when Leslie is cold and distant. That's a lot of work, and it demonstrates Anne's faith in the value of Leslie's friendship, in the value of Leslie herself, that she's willing to stick around through all of this.
Yeah. As spring comes to Four Winds, so too does Anne's long-awaited hope for motherhood. Anne tells Leslie, whose initial response is bitterness, quote, "So you are to have that too," she says coldly, and then she leaves. But later, Leslie gives Anne a beautifully sewn baby dress as a gift. Anne sees the time, effort, and money that Leslie put into the dress and appreciates that Leslie is sharing Anne's joy in the only way she really can. Anne's baby is born after a long and harrowing labor, and sadly, the baby does not survive the day. This is an awful chapter in Anne and Gilbert's life, and one we aren't going to spend too much time on here. Suffice it to say that Leslie and Captain Jim are both proved right in a way. Anne's labor is drawn out and dangerous, and Leslie knows that she might be in danger of losing another person whom she is growing to love. There's a reason Leslie keeps people at arm's length. She has experienced so much loss, she knows it could come for her again at any moment. Leslie later confides to Anne that she, quote, "realized just what your friendship has come to mean to me, just what you meant, and just what a hateful little beast I had been." Leslie explains that although she loved Anne at times, at other times she resented and envied Anne's happiness. When Anne's life was in danger, Leslie was certain that it was because Leslie hadn't been able to love Anne wholeheartedly. There was always that core of misery standing between them. Now, that is a wild take on Leslie's part. I understand that fear and grief aren't logical, but look at how much Leslie takes on herself, how much she blames herself for. I mean, if she could find a way to blame herself for Anne's loss, what is Leslie telling herself about her parents and her brother? Throughout this whole conversation, though, Anne is forgiving and understanding, and the two women are able to reconcile, and, true to Captain Jim's assessment, after Anne suffers this life-changing loss, she and Leslie are able to connect on a more profound level, and their friendship grows.
We can't talk about the loss of this first baby without also talking about Leslie's sudden and fierce response, though. It's so interesting to me that Maud includes this, and it makes me love her as an author even more. As Miss Cornelia and Marilla are packing up the little baby garments, this is what we hear. I envy Anne, said Leslie suddenly and fiercely, and I'd envy her even if she had died. She was a mother for one beautiful day. I'd gladly give my life for that.
Oof. It's a gut punch, isn't it? To be envious of someone who has just experienced so shattering a loss? I mean, it doesn't seem right, and Miss Cornelia quickly shushes Leslie, sure that if Marilla Cuthbert overheard, she would think Leslie quite terrible. But it's such a big, emotionally honest expression of the harrowing pain that comes from wanting to be a parent and having that experience denied. It feels really brave, both that Leslie articulates this and that Maud includes it in the book at all. When we talk about how Maud was writing these, like, incredibly true-to-life stories about women and women's lives, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. Maud is holding space for the immense grief of losing a child and the misery of not being able to be a mother all in the same moment. I mean, it's astonishing. And you know what? I think if Marilla overheard Leslie, she'd understand. She's had some experience with big emotions and thwarted dreams and deep grief.
Yes. And that feeling is so big, it quite overwhelms reason and rational thinking. It encapsulates the depths of Leslie's hopelessness. Leslie hasn't made peace with, nor should she have to, the current conditions of her life. It's not just that she's experienced so many tragedies in her past. It's that she can't see a future for herself in which she's able to give love. Now, Marilla would likely never express thoughts like these due to her religious beliefs. That's too much like saying that God got it wrong. But Marilla does know how important it is to have someone to love. That's what Anne brought to Marilla's life. It actually reminds me a little bit of The Blue Castle. If you remember, when Valency suddenly realizes that she loves Barney, she feels fulfilled. Just being able to love him made her richer, made her more significant, regardless of whether he loved her back. Leslie has no one to love in that wholehearted way, not a child, not a partner. And the tragedy of her circumstance that everyone keeps alluding to is that Leslie has the capacity for enormous love and loyalty and passion. And what's tragic is that that capacity is being squandered. In any case, over the next few months, Leslie and Anne continue to grow closer without Leslie's bitterness coming between them anymore. Both Anne and Leslie thrive in each other's company. They're somewhat isolated out so close to the harbor, and having a like-minded friend to spend the days with that might otherwise be lonely is important to both of them. And with their tragedies out in the open between the two, I imagine they don't have to pretend on days when the grief is strong. That's a special kind of relief to have a friend that can just bear witness to your grief and understand it without having to pretend that everything is fine.
And then we add in Owen Ford to the mix. Owen is a journalist from Toronto who is recovering from a bad bout of typhoid and hoping to find inspiration for a great Canadian novel. He wants a seaside vacation to rest and recover, and he specifically chose Four Winds because his grandparents were the original occupants of the House of Dreams, and he'd love to see this piece of family history. Owen boards for the summer at Leslie's house, and this is a situation that Leslie has often participated in to bring in a little extra money. Miss Cornelia even says that in the past, some of the boarders have hit on Leslie, but she always freezes them out. So she doesn't think much about it when she arranges for Owen to board with her. Owen, much like Anne was, is surprised to find that Mrs. Dick Moore isn't a middle-aged, comfortable, bossy farm wife. As Anne walks Owen Ford up to the Moore's house that first evening, we see Leslie as Owen sees her. She's wearing a plain, cheap dress, but one that has her usual girdle of crimson, standing in the warm light of the open door. Leslie always wears a bit of red, and for Anne, that symbolizes Leslie's, quote, glowing pent-up personality, denied all expression, save in that flaming glint. Maud tells us that Leslie's arms gleamed like ivory-tinted marble. Every exquisite curve of her form was outlined in soft darkness against the light. Her hair shone in it like flame. Owen gasps in surprise and admiration when Anne tells him that this is Mrs. Moore. He says, I never saw anything like her, he answered rather dazedly. I wasn't prepared. I didn't expect. Good heavens, one doesn't expect a goddess for a landlady. Why, if she were clothed in a gown of sea purple with a rope of amethysts in her hair, she would be a veritable sea queen. And she takes in boarders?
Oh, I'm sorry, that last line always, that just makes me laugh so much.
Anne reminds him that Leslie is a real person and that even goddesses must live. And Leslie isn't a goddess. She's just a very beautiful woman, as human as the rest of us. So I think we are seeing Anne's growth in this area. Seeing up close not only Leslie's pain, pain caused in part by her beauty, and her humanity, in her vulnerability, her occasional pettiness and bitterness, her honesty, and all the very flawed feelings and reactions. All of that has finally made Leslie a person, not a goddess, for Anne. She sees past Leslie's stunning beauty to her full personhood, and she quickly reminds Owen of this. So, good job, Anne. We love to see the growth.
Owen is young, about 30 years old, and intelligent and attuned to the poetry of life that instantly marks him as a kindred spirit for Anne and Leslie both. Anne says, quote, "He looks as if life hasn't been altogether easy for him somehow." But we get no further elaboration on what Owen's past may have held for him. Leslie's initial coldness and brusqueness with Owen doesn't last long at all, and he's quickly incorporated into their little group, completing them as a foursome of peers, rounded out by Captain Jim's wisdom on occasion. And the Leslie of this summer is not like the past Leslies that have hosted boarders the previous years when she was cold and distant. This Leslie, in the warmth of Anne's friendship, is vibrant and full of life. They have an idyllic summer. This must be healing for Anne and Gilbert in the wake of their loss, and clearly awakens a joy in Leslie that has previously been dormant. Maud writes, "Ever since the day on which she had made her confession to Anne, Leslie had been a changed creature. There was no trace of her old coldness and reserve, no shadow of her old bitterness. The girlhood of which she had been cheated seemed to come back to her with the ripeness of womanhood. She expanded like a flower of flame and perfume. No laugh was readier than hers, no wit quicker in the twilight circles of that enchanted summer. When she could not be with them, all felt that some exquisite savor was lacking in their intercourse. Her beauty was illumined by the awakened soul within, as some rosy lamp might shine through a flawless vase of alabaster. There were hours when Anne's eyes seemed to ache with the splendor of her." So while Anne has reminded Owen of Leslie's humanity just a chapter ago, this passage continues to describe Leslie in deeply poetic terms that don't seem quite real. And if I quibble with House of Dreams as a story, it's here. It's in this. I know that Maud is doing something specific with Leslie, but I don't feel like I ever get to truly see Leslie's personality grow and shine on the page. We get to hear how Anne and how Owen view Leslie, but we rarely see her specific interactions with them when she's in this joyous, vibrant stage. I'm kind of comparing her to Philippa Gordon in Anne of the Island. While Phil is very, very pretty and knows it, once we get past the initial impressions, Maud doesn't dwell on describing her looks constantly. And we really feel like we get to know Phil intimately. We read her letters to Anne. We get to hear a lot of her conversations with Anne. We go along with Phil on her own journey of growth. We really see what her friendship with Anne is like and why Anne likes Phil so much. They have a friendship of equals. Whereas with Leslie, aside from her big confession to Anne, we don't get to see a lot of their interactions, just these poetic descriptions of her that really set her apart in scope from the ordinary.
Reagan, I think that's a really interesting observation, and I'm a little torn. On the one hand, I think that Maud uses these grandiose descriptions of Leslie's beauty to kind of set her apart for a reason. And I think that reason is sort of, as we've been discussing throughout the podcast, to play with and maybe push back on some of these notions of beauty as a virtue, of beauty as an unqualified good, something that you always should hope to have, as young Anne did. But I really am torn, Reagan, because I do see this as a missed opportunity in this book. You know, we are told repeatedly that Leslie is special. She is divinely beautiful, yes, but also we're told that she brings something special to social gatherings, that she's intelligent and sensitive and vibrant and just this like all around amazing person. But we don't actually see her be amazing in this way. We don't hear her make jokes. We don't hear her clever insights in conversation. We don't see her spar intellectually with Gilbert or indulge in creative flights of fancy with Anne. And most upsettingly from my perspective, we don't see Leslie and Owen's romantic chemistry develop, even though it's apparently clear to everyone at Four Winds that they have a connection. So it's just a strange choice to leave so many of Leslie's best qualities off the page. You know, as you rightly point out, we know how funny and fun Philippa Gordon is because she's funny and fun on the page. We know how devoted and darling Diana Barry is because she's devoted and darling on the page. You know, Maud has no problem writing a well-rounded character. So why does she stop short of imbuing in Leslie this vivacious personality that makes her so special? You know, instead we just get these repeated reminders of her otherworldly beauty and then, you know, some like intensely bitter or regretful comments from Leslie here and there. So it's like the real Leslie, this Leslie who they all adore, ends up being a cipher for the reader. She's just like an empty vessel that the reader can pour their own idea of good qualities into.
Yeah, I'm really thinking about this particular chapter of their beautiful summer all together.
Yeah.
And it's just a summary of it. We don't ever get to see it in the kind of details, like I'm thinking about the way we see the little vignettes in Patty's Place, right? Mm. Hey, we get to listen to Miss Cornelia go on and on and on. Like, we have a good sense of Miss Cornelia's voice.
Yes.
Right? We get the rhythms of the way that she speaks. We get her wit. We get what's funny to her.
Same with Captain Jim. These characters are really alive. They jump off the page. We can hear them in conversation. We understand what makes them so much fun.
Right. Leslie is remarkable. Everybody says it, but we don't really get to see that. We only get to see the details of the worst parts of her, right?
Yeah. It's so unfair. It's unfair to Leslie.
In any case, with Leslie being this spectacular of a person, it is very natural for Owen Ford. He can't help but become enamored with Leslie over the summer. In fact, as he writes Captain Jim's life book, we find out that he is infusing Captain Jim's lost Margaret with Leslie's personality. So he's kind of making Leslie into a work of mythology as well. Mm-hmm. And not just her looks, but now her personality.
But like, what personality?
I know. We need more than just her tragedy or her beauty.
Yes. You know, clearly we just need to read Captain Jim's life book.
If only we could.
Yeah. Seriously, though. As the summer draws to a close, on the eve of his departure from Four Winds, Owen confesses his love for Leslie to Anne.
Because she has kind eyes.
Right.
Poor Anne.
I mean, this is kind of another thing to your point about we don't get to see them that summer. We hear about how the four of them had this great summer rambling around, Anne and Gilbert, Leslie and Owen doing all the things. But like, we don't actually understand that they have reached this level of intimacy where Owen is now going to Anne and like confiding these secrets to her, right? Like, it all just feels a little strange. Anne is sympathetic, but she's also very clear that Leslie is not free to love Owen. And Owen knows that. He's not planning to tell her about his love. He's not going to burden Leslie with that information. And while he tells Anne that the worst of it is that he knows he's leaving Leslie to misery, as he says, quote, with nothing to look forward to but growing old in a succession of empty, meaningless, barren years. Ouch. But, you know, Owen loves her, and he would give anything to be the person who would make her happy. He tells Anne that Leslie is, quote, so richly fitted for life. Again, using that term rich to describe her as like, as kind of a more gentle way of referencing Leslie's capacity for passion and love. You know, and then he tells Anne it's not just her beauty, but he dwells like kind of extensively on her beauty. He says, her beauty is the least of her dower. And she is the most beautiful woman I've ever known. That laugh of hers, I've angled all summer to evoke that laugh just for the delight of hearing it. And her eyes, they are as deep and blue as the gulf out there. I never saw such blueness and gold. You know, so her beauty is the least of her good qualities. But by the way, let me talk about her eyes. And then he goes on to describe this one time he saw Leslie's hair down when he came home unexpectedly and she was standing on the porch in the sun to dry her hair. He said, it fell all about her to her feet in a fountain of living gold. When she saw me, she hurried in and the wind caught her hair and swirled it all around her, Danae and her cloud. Somehow, just then, the knowledge that I loved her came home to me and I realized I loved her from the moment I first saw her, standing against the darkness in that glow of light.
So again, tells Anne that Leslie's looks aren't the most important part of his love for her. And then he waxes rhapsodic about her beauty, again invoking mythology to describe her, and says he realizes he loved her since the moment he saw her when she hadn't even seen him yet. That can only be about the way that Leslie looks.
Right. And then, you know, the moment, of course, where his love for her crystallizes is in this moment when he saw her with her hair down. And, you know, in this time period, that would like essentially be the equivalent of like seeing her nude, right? It's like this intensely erotic moment. I mean, like erotic for these books anyway. And so much of Owen's love really does just seem to come down to Leslie's physical appearance and Owen's reaction to it.
Right. I'm not saying that Owen's love for Leslie is shallow. I'm sure it's not, but I need more details of it here.
Yeah, we just need more.
In any case, Owen leaves, vowing not to return to Four Winds, and Anne finds Leslie the next night down at the shore as she's walking the sandbar in agitation. Anne immediately guesses why Leslie is agitated, and Leslie confirms that she's in love with Owen. She beats herself up for her wickedness, for daring to love someone when she is not free to love anyone. We see how hard Leslie is on herself. She never acted on her feelings at all, but she thinks Anne should despise her. She's so ashamed. And this is a little like how Leslie framed Anne's brush with death as punishment for her for having been resentful of Anne's happiness. She really puts a huge burden on herself. Leslie shares that when Owen was here, she didn't feel alone. And this seems like such a small example of what Owen has framed as a deep and everlasting love. Leslie shares that in the past, when Anne and Gilbert would take their leave of Leslie and walk off, she would feel alone and left out. It highlighted how very alone she was. But when Owen was here, they could walk home together, laughing and talking, and she was no longer lonely or envious. Now, I'm sure that there is more to their relationship than that, a bigger reason why Leslie loves Owen, but we don't get into it here.
The next year speeds by, and Leslie does not speak of Owen at all. In the spring, Gilbert tells Leslie about a possible procedure that could maybe restore Dick Moore's mind. We have already discussed why Anne was so upset by this. And Leslie, for her part, is described in less glorious terms for the first time as she faces this tough choice. She's pale and resolute and has wrapped herself in aloofness to deal with this tough decision. She's talking about it in a crisp and businesslike way with Gilbert and refusing Anne's warmth and understanding. Anne knew that Leslie would opt to do the procedure, and she knows that Leslie is already in the process of protecting herself the only way she knows how. Anne says, "If the operation is successful and Dick Moore finds himself again, Leslie will retreat into some remote fastness of her soul where none of us can ever find her." When Gilbert wonders if perhaps Leslie would leave Dick, Anne knows that Leslie won't do that. Her sense of duty is very strong. She told me once that her grandmother West always impressed upon her the fact that when she assumed any responsibility, she must never shirk it, no matter what the consequences might be. That is one of her cardinal rules.
It's telling that we hear little of Leslie's beauty during this ordeal of spirit. Instead, the focus is on how Leslie is resolute in her duty, facing it head on like a martyr. And whether that is because now Anne is far more focused on the harrowing realities of her friend's plight, she's not seeing Leslie's beauty, she's worrying deeply for her, or whether Maud is doing this to show how much Leslie is closed up like a clam in personality. Either way, the absence of those poetic descriptions is notable.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, right? It's like the only time in the book that she isn't described as this legendary beauty, she's depicted as a martyr. So it's just like there are no small plot points for Leslie Moore, right? She's either a goddess, a queen, or a martyr. She's always some like extraordinary figure. After the operation is successful and the truth about Dick Moore has been revealed, freeing Leslie from her prison, Leslie returns home. And in the chapter where Leslie tells Anne of her experience, all the details she gleaned from George Moore, all her emotions about the experience, where she asks Anne to comfort her, we get almost no description about how Leslie looks, only that she lays her, quote, splendid golden head on Anne's lap. She's finally fully and deeply human to Anne. When Owen Ford returns to Four Winds, we are told only that as he comes into the House of Dreams, he sees Leslie with baby Jem in her lap, and he gazes greedily at the sweet picture he's observing. But there's no overwrought descriptions of Leslie as a Madonna or Owen dwelling on her beauty in any kind of extraordinary way. Only that her beautiful face goes white when she sees Owen. When Anne talks Leslie down out of her initial panicked retreat from happiness, We don't hear at all about Leslie's beauty either, only that later that night, when Leslie Dares allowed herself to hope, her eyes grew soft and bright and young once more. When Owen proposes to Leslie in the Rose Garden, he doesn't speak poetry about her beauty. In fact, his words are very simple. I have loved you from the first, and I know you love me. I don't need to ask you, but I want to hear you say it. My darling, my darling.
The last word on Leslie's looks in the book comes from Leslie herself. She says, "Do you remember, Anne, that I once said that night we met on the shore that I hated my good looks? I did then. It always seemed to me that if I had been homely, Dick would never have thought of me. I hated my beauty because it had attracted him. But now, oh, I'm glad that I have it. It's all I have to offer Owen. His artist's soul delights in it. I feel as if I do not come to him quite empty-handed." And Anne corrects her with, "Owen loves your beauty, Leslie. Who would not? But it's foolish of you to say or think that is all you bring to him. He will tell you that. I needn't." I kind of do wish she would tell her that. I kind of do want to hear all that Leslie brings to Owen. I'm sure it's wonderful, but we never really get to see that relationship at all.
I know. Last time in our episode about Miss Cornelia, I said that I wanted to hear the plot of Anne's House of Dreams from Miss Cornelia's perspective. And today I feel like I'd like to read the plot over again from Leslie's perspective as well. Right? I know that there's like a grand love story there. You know, Owen and Leslie are both too spirited and bright and sensitive to have anything but a splendid romance. But I just wish I knew what it was.
Yep. The way that Maud writes Leslie Moore is really fascinating. In the first half of the book, almost three quarters of the book, Maud writes about Leslie's preternatural beauty in the most majestic language. But as soon as both Anne and Owen actually get close to her for real, and Leslie can open her heart, be vulnerable, we stop getting these grand descriptions, right? Maud is using Leslie's beauty as a metaphor for her true nature that is hiding under her tragic backstory and cold demeanor. And her beauty is a lesson for Anne, who needs to let Leslie be a real person in order to form a true, deep friendship with her. Anne needs to truly learn that beauty doesn't make one's life as easy as she thought it would.
All right. Moving on to our birch path, I kind of wanted to talk about some examples of famous literary beauties who are also cursed by their looks. I mean, I think Leslie Moore perfectly typifies that trope, right? The tragic beauty, the woman who is so beautiful that her life has actually been miserable because of it. It's such a common theme. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you could probably write books on. I'm sure books have been written about it. I think some people have probably even witnessed it or experienced it in real life as well. And I feel like women who were cursed with beauty, that was like all over the books I was reading and the movies I was watching as a kid. I remember how Buttercup was kidnapped and then used as a political pawn and nearly forced to marry Prince Humperdinck and the Princess Bride, all because of her legendary beauty. And then, of course, another iconic character from my childhood, Jessica Rabbit in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. She told Eddie Valiant, "You don't know how hard it is being a woman looking the way I do." These are women for whom there's always something unsafe or dangerous or sinister about being a woman who is too beautiful. But of course, the 1980s were not the first decade to explore the trope of cursed beauty. So for that, we are going to have to go much further back to a time when history and myth overlap. In mythology, women who are so beautiful that they tempt the gods and enrage the goddesses is an ancient story, with examples that span cultures and time periods. In ancient Greece, examples abound. Psyche, Andromeda, Medusa, all beautiful women who came to tragic ends. The Greeks believed that physical beauty was a double-edged sword, either blessing or curse, often depending on your gender and status. A good-looking nobleman was rightly blessed with looks that matched his status, but an extraordinarily beautiful woman was viewed with suspicion. Thought to be powerful enough to control men, beautiful women were dangerous. Helen of Troy is our classic example, right? The face that launched 1,000 ships and caused the Trojan War. There was an almost inevitability to the trouble that Helen's beauty would cause. When she was a very young child, she was abducted because of her beauty. And then as a young princess of Sparta, her suitors nearly started a war just for her hand in marriage. Near the end of the Trojan War, as Helen is walking along the walls of Troy, the old men of the benighted city start to chatter, muttering that now that they have seen her, they understand why these two great peoples, the Trojans and the Greeks, had to fight for her. "What beauty Helen has," they said, "a terrible beauty like that of the goddess." And of course, this is a very patriarchal framing of a historical story that honestly was mostly fiction even in Homer's time. I don't think I should have to say this, but just in case, beautiful women do not force men to abduct or assault them, and beautiful women do not cause men to go to war. Anyone's ability to make decisions has nothing to do with another person's attractiveness, but this is where we get this trope of cursed beauty in these classic tales where a woman's beauty is the excuse that men use to justify their behavior.
I mean, that goes back very much to what we were just saying about how women's worth is defined by the way that men value them.
Yeah. And that's the very heart of this whole trope, right? It's not actually that beautiful women are cursed. It's not actually that the gods are punishing them for being physically attractive. It's that they are harmed by the people around them who either take advantage of their beauty or who resent them for it. It's so interesting to me that Anne, we know her to have been a very well-read kid, that she would have still yearned to be divinely beautiful, when surely she would have also been aware that beauty is not without its challenges. We do know that she read Tennyson's Lancelot and Elaine, another example of a cursed beauty. In our Girls of Avonlea episode, we discussed that the Avonlea girls were studying Alfred Lord Tennyson's epic poem Idylls of the King, which was Tennyson's take on Arthurian legend, when they were inspired to act out Elaine's funeral scene. In Tennyson's version of the legend, Elaine is described as Elaine the Fair, Elaine the Lovable, Elaine the Lily Maid of Astolat. So Elaine is the beautiful and innocent daughter of a nobleman, and when Lancelot visits her at her father's home, he, of course, is courteous to her. But Elaine misunderstands and falls in love with Lancelot, aided in no small part by the fact that when she asks him to wear her favor in a tournament, he agrees. I'm like, Lancelot, come on. Lancelot arrives at the tournament wearing Elaine's favor, and Guinevere sees this and is jealous and angry. Lancelot ends up getting wounded at the tournament, and when Elaine hears of this, she basically runs away from home to find Lancelot and nurse him back to health. She does this. As she nurses him, she falls even more deeply in love with Lancelot. Once he's restored to health, though, he tells Elaine he cannot love her, right? He's in love with Guinevere, and he sends her home. She then dies of a broken heart. Lancelot arranges for her funeral, the very one that Anne and her friends reenacted.
You know, Kelly, this actually makes sense when you just said a little bit about why a well-read kid with Anne would not have caught on to the idea that beauty is not all it's cracked up to be. Remember how romantic Anne thought death was?
Yes. Oh, that's right.
Elaine died. Elaine was beautiful and she died. And that was deeply romantic.
What made the story so great.
She was delighted to play the lily maid floating to her watery grave.
Young Anne, childhood Anne, didn't really appreciate these tragedies, right? She saw it all as part of a grand romance. Remember the girls in the story club weeping gallons of tears as they killed off all their characters?
Absolutely.
They were not thinking about the real life tragedies that they were creating.
Right. Okay, so we can extrapolate a little bit. Ruby Gillis dying taught Anne about how death was not actually all that romantic. It's actually a tragedy. And here's Leslie, unfortunately, as an object lesson, teaching Anne more of that same lesson that being pursued and wanted for your beauty, being a tragic figure, is not actually romantic. It's actually just hard.
It's actually just hard. And what makes for beautiful poetry,
right,
scene to act out with your girlfriends, is not something you would ever want to live.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting, Reagan. So as we were talking about earlier in this episode, authors will often use beauty, virtue, or both as a sort of shorthand to make readers care about a female character more. I mean, this was certainly true in the Victorian era. Examples of beautiful women with tragic lives absolutely abound. And I think there's something kind of remarkable in the way that mostly Maud doesn't do that in the Anne books. I mean, Anne herself is engaging with some of those ideas that beauty means worthiness, but Maud, From her omniscient narration perspective, she is perfectly comfortable writing characters who are plain because she takes the time to properly personify her characters. You know, it doesn't matter that Anne has an unfashionable hair color. It doesn't matter that Marilla is thin and sallow or that Mrs. Rachel is old and fat. They are all fabulously interesting characters, lovable for their imperfections and very real. So I think it's very in keeping with the kind of realistic fiction that Maud was writing. So it stands out all the more when she does use some of that particularly grandiose language to describe Leslie Moore. And she doesn't offer to Leslie the benefit of those more well-rounded characterization in other ways. You know, all of this just serves to solidify Leslie as not being quite of Anne's world. She's just a sort of myth or legend in her own right. And I think that Maud made this choice to describe Leslie in this particularly heightened way to enable a sort of final phase of Anne's growth, like we were just talking about. Just as Anne came to love her modest little house of dreams as much as any of her fantasy castles in Spain, she also needed to encounter a goddess divine in real life to finally learn that divine beauty isn't all it's cracked up to be.
That was so interesting.
At any rate, you know, oftentimes when we do these character deep dives, I end up liking the character even more, but I am not sure that I'm having that same experience with Leslie. I wish that Leslie was more human woman and less archetype. But I do have a little puffed sleeve detail that I want to make sure we discuss before we wrap up our discussion of this mysterious lady. As we mentioned, Leslie is always wearing a pop of red, a red ribbon, a red flower in her hair, or tucked into her belt, or pinned at her neckline. And when Owen proposes to Leslie, he does so as they admire the red roses in bloom. Now, Anne believes that all these red touches are symbolic of Leslie's, you know, hidden brilliance and passion, but I actually really like the way Leslie herself puts it. She says that she never feels satisfied without a gleam of red somewhere. I almost see these little touches of red as Leslie's way of keeping faith with herself. She may have sacrificed everything for her family and for Dick, but she always does this one small thing for herself every day.
That is one of those lovely details that tells us something more about Leslie. I wish we had even more of those.
Yeah, very much so.
And actually, my puffed sleeve moment is a little bit along those same lines. One of the little details I like about Leslie is that we find out how much she loves her old dog how he had been her only company for so long. Leslie is so sad after he dies that she won't let Anne get her a puppy yet. She needs time to mourn this specific dog. He's not easily replaced to her. And that's just a lovely little glimpse into Leslie's personality. It actually reminds me about how we discussed in Windy Poplars that Catherine Brooks' desire to have a dog is the first real hint we have of the true nature underneath her spikiness. Anybody who loves a dog has got to be a good person, right?
Yes, that is true. Beauty is not telling, but whether or not you love a dog definitely is. So my inspired by Leslie is going to be partially inspired by Leslie and her little pops of red, but also, Reagan, it is going to be partially inspired by your daughter, Alice.
She will always be happy to know that she has provided some inspiration.
So last weekend, Reagan shared with me some photos of Alice and all of her friends getting ready for a school dance. And listeners, let me just observe that the 90s are back in a big way. I mean, they were wearing baby doll dresses, plaid skirts, combat boots. That was very much the order of the day. But I also noticed that several of the girls were wearing very cute little chokers. And then when I was reading the Leslie parts of the book again, I was reading about how she would wear like a scarlet flower at her throat. So of course I was inspired. I had to Google red flower chokers, and y'all, they are out there and they are beautiful. There are beautiful accessories at Free People, at Lulu's, Eloquy, and Anthropology. Those are all stores I found them at. There's a bunch of different options at several different price points for like a beautiful choker length necklace adorned with a big red rose. And the one that I especially have my eye on right now is the red Melody choker at Free People, which has these sort of long ribbons of red velvet trailing down the back as well. I know Leslie Moore would have loved it.
Fantastic. Those flower chokers would have looked so good with many of these outfits that the girls were wearing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, my inspired by the fairy tale aspect of Leslie's story. Listeners, if you have never read any of Robin McKinley's fairy tale retellings, I'm here to tell you that you must. We've already referenced that Dick Moore reminds us of Gaston in Disney's Beauty and the Beast. And that's what made me think of McKinley, because she has written two very different but equally wonderful takes on that fairy tale. One is called Beauty, and I've loved that book since I think I was in eighth grade. And the other is called Rose Daughter. They're both innovative, and in both, the heroine gets a fully fleshed out personality. McKinley also wrote another book that makes me think of Leslie Moore. It's also inspired by a fairy tale, but a less well-known fairy tale called Donkey Skin. This book that McKinley's written is called Deer Skin, and it's very dark. So I'm just going to put out a trigger warning for folks for violence against women if you read it. So don't read it if that's something you're feeling sensitive to. But if you do read it, it's an extremely powerful book. And in this, the heroine, like Leslie, finds that her extraordinary beauty is also a curse, and she must persevere and discover her own power. McKinley also wrote a book called Spindle's End, which is a great retelling of Sleeping Beauty. So if you've never read any of Robin McKinley's books, let this be your inspiration.
Oh, those are great recommendations, Reagan.
Well, kindred spirits, we have just loved having you for our discussion of Leslie Moore. I hope you will join us next time as we talk about that old salty dog, Captain Jim, and unconventional intelligence. If you are enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share about our podcast on your social media feeds. That's really the best way for new kindred spirits to find the podcast and share the love of all things Anne. If you do review or share about this podcast, just send us an email at kindredspirits.bookclub@gmail.com or DM us on our Instagram, also kindredspirits.bookclub, and we will send you a beautiful Kindred Spirits Book Club sticker, perfect to adorn your water bottle or e-reader. Follow us on Instagram too for peeks into upcoming episodes and other bookish posts. And as always, thank you for listening, Kindred Spirits.
Thank you, Kindred Spirits. Goodbye.